China, do you want to talk at all about what it was like to be reached out to, and you know what convinced you to say yes and participate? What that was like?
Well, I think Mike had initially reached out to me, and he was going to talk to me, and so I was willing to talk to Mike because I knew, you know, who he was, and you know, I remember when Mike first came to town. I think I was a teenager, so this is a long time ago. But anyway, he reached out to me, and then something happened. I forget what, but then Selena had reached out. So I think just knowing that Mike was a part of it made me feel like this was something legit that I could you know, speak to, because I knew that, you know, I didn't know who else was involved, but I know that you guys asked me, I think Selena had asked me, Selena interviewed me, of other people that were there. And I, you know, mentioned a few people, but I, you know, I used their street name or whatever, because I didn't know what, you know, some people don't want to be contacted. I mean, I've kind of done a lot of, I had to go underground, is kind of how it felt, to protect myself, because of the, apparently there was like a hit out on us from the Tom Metzger. So I remember a group of skins coming up here and saying that they were looking for me and a couple of other people. I can't even remember. So, you know, it was something that I had to distance myself from. And I kind of left the community just because it wasn't safe for me. I had to move on. But so, I trusted it because Mike, and then, you know, just, I wanted it to, I felt like, you know, it was good to speak about what had happened, and because nobody had really asked before. And like, I'm here telling war story, telling these people stories. People are looking at me like, what? You know, because, you know, the life that I'm in now apparently doesn't seem to match what was going on. That I'm definitely the same person, but you know, you do a lot of work to build yourself. And, you know, I had to leave the scene to take care of myself. You know, I had to leave it. And that was, it's not that I didn't have love, but sometimes you just got to take care of yourself. And I haven't left the community. I still do community work, but there's many different ways to do that. You know, like being a mom and raising kids is a lot, you know, that's an activism in its own right. Anyway, I just trusted the process. You know, I mean, it's been, what, 30 something years, you know, since all that happened. So I felt like it was safe to speak. And, you know, I knew Mike, and I listened to KBOO when I was like an 11-year-old, and that was the only place you could hear underground punk rock, you know. That's, so I trust KBOO, you know, you'd hear all these underground, now it's like available, but that was my source. So I was kind of happy to loop back in a way of sorts to KBOO.
Yeah, we didn't have the internet back then. You couldn't just click and find anything. So,
exactly.
Yeah. What has it been like, Mike, in China? Just to speak more about that, to what have been the reactions from the podcast, from either folks who were in the scene with you, who were in the community with you at the time, or from other folks who've met since then, who maybe learned more about that part of your life from listening to the podcast. What have the reactions been like?
Well, I'll just speak really quick. So, a lot of people, I mean, I have a few friends from back then, and they were so like, wow, they were like, you know, we need to hear the story. It's so important. So my few handful of friends that knew me then and knew about the podcast were really excited. And it's been kind of my community that I'm, my main community, they don't know this part about me. So this has been kind of interesting for them to see this other part of me that's very much a part of me. It's been interesting, and I think it's still unfolding.
Yeah, I can you, Eliza, can you restate that? I just don't, when you're muted. Yeah. I don't want to go off on a tangent and like not address.
But it. If it's an interesting tangent, we want it. But it was, what I was asking is, what have the reactions from folks, either who were in community with you then, or maybe don't know that much about this part of your life? So from both of those groups, what have the reactions to the podcast been like?
You know, it's been good to see and hear the responses from people in my community who weren't part of it. It's, you know, there was a lot of importance attached to the commitment and the sacrifice, you know? And for all these years to have passed, and now for people who weren't part of it to go, man, I'm really glad that these stories are being told. And to know that it inspires people is amazing. I mean, what more can we ask for, right? For people who were part of it, I just got wind that two of my friends who were fellow Minneapolis Baldies and anti-racist skinheads, both non-white, a Black anti-racist skinhead, one of my best friends, David Jeffries, and another, one of the co-founders of the Baldies, Native American, Jay Nevels, they're going to do their own podcast now called Sticks and Stones. And so what I'm hoping is continued inspiration, you know, that more people are going to be encouraged to tell stories from their perspective. Because ultimately what we want to be able to do, you know, is, and I'm speaking in kind of a generic sense, what we want to be able to do is inspire future generations to go, you know, these things that I'm feeling have a place. And there's ways to do something about the way I feel with other people.
I think that's so key that we letting the next generations know that they aren't alone in a way, and that, you know, I think what you said is absolutely, because I see younger people hearing about this and that are interested in activism and what the movement has been like, and for them to know that there were people that started this a long time ago is empowering and validating for them, I think.
I'd be really interested to hear you all speak some about what you're seeing, what you haven't seen, particularly over the past year. There's definitely a lot of fighting happening in the streets. There's fighting between anti-fascist activists and white supremacists and neo-Nazis for sure. And then also fighting between anti-fascist activists and police really explicitly. And so as you're seeing that, and, you know, Mike, you talked about, you know, being in touch and having close friends who are engaged in some of that work right now. I'm interested to know what you think about that as you're looking at it. What are the connections between the anti-racist actions that you all undertook and that were discussed in the podcast? And what do you want to say about, you know, those kinds of fights that are happening now? I would say particularly here in the Pacific Northwest, but also feel free to broaden it out, because, you know, we do know these fights are happening not just here, but, you know, in other parts of the United States and in other parts of the world, as we see so much fascism. So what do you want us to think about on those parts?
We have a role to play, all of us, each and every one of us. You know, the information is available. We can look critically at history and the current moment, and we can actually visualize where things are headed. It doesn't take, you don't have to be a genius or a rocket surgeon, right? You just have to pay attention and look at where things are. And I think this thing that happened, the insurrection, right? The dumpster fire that happened on January 6th, like, these things are all predictable. Well, the short-sighted could blame Donald Trump, but what we're seeing is a continuum, you know, of white supremacist violence based on this entitlement to land and resources and the use of violence to secure dominance. And that's what, unfortunately, that's what this nation was built on. And it's still at the core of how people are behaving. So we're going to continue to see the vanishing of white entitlement based on the objective realities of capitalism transitioning from extraction into speculation. And what happens when you transition from extraction and production and manufacturing into speculation is that financial products no longer have anything to do with labor. And in that, masses of workers who had previously held a premium on their access to the highest paying jobs are now unemployable. But instead of looking at that process scientifically as part of economic transition, what they're going to be doing is scapegoating. And the lie and the mythology of white supremacy told them that they were on top because they had a God-given right to be on top. And they believed that lie for so long that it's very hard for them to acknowledge that it was a lie. And they would rather kill than to accept that it would be in their interest to let go of the lie. So that's what we're facing. We're going to see more violence. The state is in an interesting position because the state is moving from an explicitly white supremacist fascist orientation into a neoliberal fascist orientation. And what I mean when I say neoliberal, it has more to do, the state interest now has more to do with unregulated free market speculation on a global level, where the ultra rich are in it with each other to become ultra rich. And so it can be very confusing to listen to the media say things like, well, when the people stormed the Capitol on January 6th, there were all these active military people and all these off-duty police. How could that possibly happen? How could that not happen? So when we're fighting Nazis as teenagers, what we're actually fighting against is we're fighting against the working class foot soldiers who drank the Kool-Aid of white supremacy, who were the buffer between true revolutionary movement for human rights and justice in an egalitarian sense. They were the buffer. The white working class has always been the buffer between the progress that we could make as a society and the rule of the elite. And they're still here. So what we have to look forward to is a reckoning that can involve a shift in consciousness, and that's the work we have to do. How do we do the work in society that can inform and transform our collective consciousness so that we no longer allow our self-interest to be aligned with destruction?
Wow. What else can I add to that, Mike? I mean, amazing vision. And I see everything that you're saying. All I could speak to is, I mean, what I see is that the mask is off. I mean, if it was ever on, and I ask myself, are things more violent? Then are the police more violent than they were back then? But no, they weren't. It's just that maybe there's more mass violence where we're hearing about it more. So I think we're seeing exactly what Mike is saying. I think we're seeing kind of the breakdown of our society and there is I don't want to say a war, but there's definitely a movement of and shift from wealth and power. And a redistribution to the people, you know, is what I see too. I think, you know, we're seeing very blatant acts of racist bullying. And I often question was it this bad before? I mean, it was terrible before, but it seems like people that we see as professionals, like teachers or, you know, just people that are supposed to support, just showing these blatant ugly racist faces. I mean, they were always there, obviously, but it's like we see the demon. I see it, you know, sadly, very often. And, you know, it's not new, but you just sometimes the violence and the abuses and what people are facing. I mean, the forces that are supposed to protect us killing people that are protecting people. You know what I'm saying? And it's some people, you know, it's like, who can you trust? You know, and certainly we know better about who we can trust, but you still find yourself saying, who can we trust? Who can we trust?
Yeah, and to add to that, with the masks are off and more people are seeing the white entitlement and the white supremacy that we have been, you know, that's been part of this, you know, this culture since it's been invented. One of the things I feel like that people comment on often is like, these people were kids. A lot of the interviews say it, like, we were kids, we were just kids. And the people currently who are doing this fighting on the street as Antifa, as whatever, are also just kids. And we, as the rest of society, have a responsibility to support those kids, because the police are, you know, the police are involved in white supremacy and upholding power. The structures of society that white people are taught to use to protect themselves are all white supremacists. So these kids who are doing the work now have much less visible support from the overall community that I think has happened definitely after the Mulligata Saraw murder, definitely not happening before that, you know. So I think those of us who maybe aren't street fighters, or who have families, or who have more to lose, or who have more injuries or something, there's a role that we need to play to not involve the state, to not involve white supremacist structures, and to support these people who are actually fighting white supremacy. And so we just have to, you know, figure out your way to do it, and figure out what you're comfortable with, figure out what's needed, listen to the Antifa and Street Fighter kids when they tell you, and believe them when they tell you things, and step up.
And I think it's, Mike.
I was just gonna say, interrupt, you know, interrupt that. What Aaron said, step up, I wanna add on. When you see it going down, interrupt.
And I also want to say that, you know, we hear about a diversity of tactics are needed. And to think about, I guess I think about people on the streets as like holding a line. They've drawn a line and they are holding that for all of us. And they do need support, for sure.
And I think we need to spread the work out. I mean, absolutely, we support the kids and the people that are out there fighting, but we can't just, you know, lean on them so much that they're, you know, getting hurt and burn out. More people with privilege need to step up and fight this fight. It's not just these kids out there, people that are so marginalized, they really feel that they have no choice but to fight, but people that are in privilege, we need to address your privilege every day and support, you know, financially. If you can't go fight, you know, show up, support some of the groups with your money, with your car, your transport, your access to legal systems, your access to educational systems. I mean, we have to start leveraging our privilege if we have it. And we all have varying degrees of privilege. I mean, as Americans, we have a privilege, but, you know, everyone has different degrees. So I'm really about everyone analyzing their own privileges and leveraging it as best as they can, not to the point where we don't have enough for ourselves, but where we are just constantly in a space where we're adjusting and thinking how we can support, and not just relying on the work of people that are putting their bodies on the line.
Thanks, y'all. Well, we're nearing the time we had set aside for this conversation, so I'll just do one more shout out. If folks have questions, to go ahead and put them in the chat or in the comment on Facebook, and we'll get them moved over here. So if there are any audience questions, to go ahead and put those in. And I guess, you know, one other question that I want to make sure we don't miss, and maybe you've touched on some of this already, but feel free to just reiterate or emphasize a point, would be, what is it that you really want to make sure that people take away from this history? And take away from the stories of the people and the events and the ideas that are told in the It Did Happen Here podcast. What do you want to make sure that we know when we listen to that and come away with it?
There's a time to fight with your body. And we can't afford to be careless about the ways we fight with our bodies. We have to be smart, we have to be strategic, we have to be informed, and we better not be alone. It's not a fair fight, you guys. So we fight together because it's not fair. We fight together because we fight to survive. Unfortunately, we're often, when since we're facing a dominant system, we're often on the defense, and we're fighting to survive. One day we'll fight to win, but for now, survival is synonymous with the win. When we're not fighting with our bodies, ideally, that only happens sometimes, only when necessary. We have to fight with all the other resources we have. Like China said, our access to different degrees of privilege becomes a tool and a weapon with which to wage this fight. And one thing I'm very clear about, I'm all about egalitarianism and acceptance and accountability and inclusivity and this, that, and the other. But white supremacy is evil. Racial terror is evil. The very existence of the ideological framework is based on people getting away with murder.
Truly evil, absolutely.
So let's not forget that. When we want to make a fair and equal level playing field for everyone to have their objective, you know, opportunity to say what they say, we cannot tolerate racial terror and violence. It does not have a place in the type of world we want to create.
One thing I would like people to take away is to keep in mind that histories can be forgotten and erased, and that it's important to keep those stories alive and remember and pass it down, document.
And I think also, like, this is it's a 6.5-hour podcast, and this is years and years of people's lives and multiple people's lives and perspectives. So it's reductive. And luckily we did our best. And there's a lot of people who see themselves in these experiences, but there's a lot of experiences of people who, you know, didn't live through it who don't feel safe talking about it, or who had to, leave in the middle of the fight because of, couldn't hang anymore with the interpersonal violence or problems or whatever. You know, there's a lot of reasons. So also just remember, I think every historical perspective that gets told like this is reductive, and it's an important thing to keep in mind when you're listening to any stories, including this. And it is important to keep telling your stories to make sure that, like, they do eventually get included in, you know, an official event like this. Like, you know, I'm really appreciative to the Oregon Historical Society, also knowing that this isn't the kind of work that they do very often, because it is a real people's grassroots from a perspective that's often left out. So I appreciate the room being made on this platform for this to happen.
I just want to say I appreciate everyone, but I know Mike and then Selena, so I appreciate you leading, making the space to tell the story, because I agree, we have to tell the stories. History is forgotten often, and we should tell our story So that, for one, so that someone else can't rewrite it in a negative way, and also because it is easily to be forgotten. And I want to reiterate what Mike said. This white supremacist system is evil, and there isn't a two sides kind of equal participation. That's a lie, you know. So yeah, there is a side of justice, and thanks for creating this platform.
Thank you all. We have an audience question that I think touches on some of what you were just talking about. You know, there are all, you know, we talk about this a lot at the Historical Society, like we could never get all the perspectives of all the people who lived, you know. And I, you know, we've also talked about when we've done work on white supremacy, just making very clear, like, this isn't a subject we're neutral on. This isn't something that we're interested in offering, like, both sides. Like, it's deadly. It's bad, you know? And there's a question from an audience member about what's the best way to guard against propaganda or rumors or lies that undermine solidarity? Because there are, you know, there are opposing narratives out there to, you know, the ones that you've told in this podcast. Any tips on that for our audience member, or ways to think about how to maintain solidarity in the face of propaganda and rumors and lies?
I'll speak to, go ahead, Mike, you're gonna speak.
Oh, go ahead, Shauna, I'll speak after you.
Okay, I was just going to say, go to the source, you know, don't be that person to hear something and spread it. Go talk to if you can, and research, you know, because gossip is just, you know, gossip and rumors are just, it's just kind of a low way of thinking. And, you know, even in social circles, if you hear something about someone, you don't just believe it, you check it out. So, you know, stick to facts and things that, you know, talk to the people anytime that you can, find out what's the real story. You know, there's always going to be propaganda, rumors, lies, this kind of bizarre alter story that, you know, like, again, this kind of trying to create something of there being two sides. And there really isn't here. So I think just, you know, question everything, actually, and do your research.
Being a cis-born, able-bodied male, I have been encouraged to use the space that I take up in a way where it's easier for me to feel confident and assertive about facing problems that some other people, facing some problems head on that some other people might not feel safe doing. So I want to acknowledge that. But I also want to say, go, like China said, go to the source, communicate directly. If you have heard something about somebody that you value who they are, but it's troubling what you heard, it's more important, even if it takes time for you to build up your confidence and your plan, it's more important for you to talk to that person directly and give them the opportunity to convey understanding than to destroy relationships with people who are potential allies. And we have to be careful language and semantics. We hear about cancel culture. Well, there's a reaction to cancel culture coming from the right that seeks to discredit it. And that's not healthy, because what they're trying to do is protect and maintain their power. But I want us on the left to be critical of how cancel culture can be a tool that operates against our best interests. And that when we hear things about people and all of a sudden those people want to, you know, there's a movement to deplatform people based on hearsay, that's dangerous. Talk to people directly in confidence and develop your own awareness and understanding of exactly what's going on before you make a decision to move against people.
And I also wanted to add to that, you know, part of one of the things that people brought up about us, everyone doing this work at the time being teenagers, is there was a lot of time to hang out. This is like, activism based on friendship and trust and knowing each other. So we just have to put in the time to make the community so that we do actually know each other. And then that will make it easier to then directly talk to people when there are issues and problems. It's like, first we have to, there is no shortcut into learning each other and making real community.
No, Erin, just to follow up on that, there's a question from an audience member about knowing that you've done a lot of anti-racist work, you know, as a white person, and I think they're asking for, you know, what it means to be a white activist in anti-racist work. And I feel like you answered that question in some ways just in what you were just talking about. Do you want to speak on that a little bit more?
I could speak on it a little. I mean, I think it's mostly like white supremacy is white people's problem. And, you know, like, how are you going to live with yourself if you're not doing your best to fight a system that doesn't value equal humanity? Like, it's just kind of a no-brainer to be a white activist. To be an ally is to risk making mistakes and keep working, keep showing up, like be terribly embarrassed and shamed for stupid things that I have said or thought or done, but I, you know, like very well programmed as a white person in this society. So being very well programmed and also trying to fight that with every fiber of my being is a weird and complicated place to be that's sometimes real gross and sometimes is, you know, it's sometimes very sweet then to have the relationships with people who, because of watching me fall on my face and get up and do it again, there's a lot of like sweetness and trust there. So I think that's, yeah, what it means to be is to be fully willing to act like an idiot and admit it and then keep going, you know, like shame is a gross sidekick that I have as a white person. And eventually, you know, hopefully that future folks won't be so well programmed and their shameful sidekick will get, you know, disappear eventually. You know, that's what we can hope for. That's what we can work for. Fingers crossed.
Thanks, I appreciate that. And then there's just one other question about the skills and tactics that anti-racist action use that were described in the podcast. And if anybody has tips on who's teaching folks those skills today. I feel like that's happening in a lot of places, but if anybody has a specific that they want to recommend, we'd love to hear it.
Study, look at the history, use this podcast as a resource, listen to the stories, and then figure out how to do those things in your own way with people that you trust. I think a lot of us want to follow recipes, and I get why, but some of the best food is you're cooking based on the feel. You know how much to put in because you know what you're going for. You're reverse engineering the outcome based on what your greatest desires are. So yeah, there are those of us who have done this already, and there are going to be podcasts and books and articles and things that you can read. And I want to encourage you to do that and look deeper in the history of anti-fascist and anti-racist movements and anti-oppression movements from other countries and other cultures and other societies. But ultimately, there's going to be a degree of you figuring out how to do what's real and right for you with the people that are real and right for you to do it with. And you got to be willing to do that.
Thank you. Any final words before we say our thanks and let you all go?
The group that held the Mulugeta Sarah 30th anniversary event was the Urban League of Portland. Mo, one of our fact checkers, actually texted me that. So once again, shout out to Mo. And also next Thursday, if people are interested in more of the what you can do, what's been happening, next Thursday, the Multnomah County Library is hosting a conversation with Scott Nakagawa and Eric Ward, and they'll, I'm sure, have a lot of advice on what to do in these current times. And I think, Selena, do you remember when it starts? I'm kind of, that's,
I want to say 6-ish.
That's what I was thinking too, yeah. 6, next Thursday. And then the Thursday after that, then Selena and Mike and I will be talking about more of the podcasty parts of making the podcast. So the next 2 Thursdays, if you're interested in this, you can follow us along to the Multnomah County Library Zoom link.
Thank you, Liza. Thank you, Oregon Historical Society. Thank you all for being here. And thank you to my cohort, Selena and Aaron. One love, you guys.
Yeah. Thank you all very much. We appreciate you. Have a great night. Thanks, audience, for being here. We'll post this on our website so folks can come back to it. Take care, everybody.